We've really gone full circle in terms of how we get our media, because we're back to, like, this is radio. We're doing the radio right now.
This is low stakes radio. It's not live.
Audiobooks or podcasts are also kind of like Little Orphan Annie on the radio. You know what I mean?
I totally know what you mean. Or I have this like memory of, it must have been my grandma listening to, like, I don't know what you would call it, a show, but over the radio. It wasn't an audiobook, but like it was a show.
Yeah, like Little Orphan Annie. What is that called?
Yeah.
Like a radio show.
Is that what it's called? A radio show.
Yeah, radio show.
I didn't have a name for it. It's like my grandma, same grandma, would listen to talk radio.
Mm-hmm.
Is that like not NPR. A podcast? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe that's just...
I mean, this is a personal opinion, but I feel like we are starting to exit the golden age of television.
Hmm.
Like, remember for a while there, people were like, this is the golden age of television. Yeah. So much content is coming out, and it's all brilliant. It's all good.
Could you attribute this downfall to, like, streaming services, you think?
Well,
this, like, fragmentation of media?
I think that streaming services were part of the success at first, right? Like, think about binge culture. People love to binge. Streaming services like Netflix got their gems, like Stranger Things, Orange is the New Black.
They've got Bridgerton, right? That's...
Yeah.
Well, and even when they first started streaming, they weren't creating originals, right?
No.
You were getting movies and TV shows. Did you ever get the, did you subscribe to get the DVD sent to you in the mail? Were you part of Netflix back then?
No, my family didn't do that.
I was.
That's wild.
And I think about that sometimes and how innovative and amazing that was, because it was like a family video, but, you know,
coming to your
mail
house.
To you. And that was like
huge,
crazy. I think about that time from time to time. And I think about how quick streaming services have evolved and just consumed media, like have taken over the media.
Yeah.
How does this tie into death? It doesn't.
I guess it has nothing to do with death.
The death of cable.
I mean, I guess we all... Oh, yeah. The death of cable, the death of...
What'd you say? The death of the primetime TV?
The death of the golden age of television.
So death. Keeping it super light today.
Fluffy.
Like a cloud.
Fun.
Sunshine and rainbows.
What do you got for us today, Regan?
So today, my content is a blog written by Ray Boomhauer. It is titled, The Last Enemy is Destroyed, Mayright Sewell and Spiritualism. Now, I've always been sort of a, like, back row fan of Mayright Sewell in that I know a little bit about her and her life, but never enough to be, like, a loud and proud fan. So I picked this article because I initially wanted to learn more about Mayright Sewell. The idea of spiritualism intrigued me, and I sort of love her even more because of this article, and I think that depends on how you feel about spiritualism and talking to the dead, if that's a thing that you believe in, or ghosts or spirits, but I personally do, and I really found this fascinating.
I'm excited.
Yes. Roughly 100 years ago, in May of 1920, Mayright Sewell published a book titled Neither Dead Nor Sleeping, and this book is about her experience in the, quote, shadowy world of spiritualism. That's kind of how Ray describes it. And lots of people had a lot of things to say about this book. Her publisher, who was Bob's Merrill Company, and we'll get into them in a second, but they said this book was the most talked about book of the day. And then, of course, media entities had some things to say too. Anton Scheer, who was a columnist for the Indianapolis Times, said of the book, quote, it rocked the foundations of Indianapolis quite a lot. So some big things to say. I thought it was important to give a little bio about Mayright Sewell before we kind of dove into this. May is, or was rather, a Hoosier suffragette, peace advocate, teacher, and civic leader. She played a leading role in helping to establish the Girls Classical School, the Indianapolis Women's Club, the Contemporary Club, and the Art Association of Indianapolis, and the Indianapolis Propylaeum.
Oh my goodness.
She was a busy lady.
A very busy lady.
Yeah. She worked really hard to promote women's rights, not only here in Indianapolis, but around the world. She was a pioneering member of the International Council of Women, and the National Council of Women. So she was very interested in women's rights at home and abroad. Now that we kind of know who May is, I think it's important to talk about what spiritualism is. Spiritualism is the belief in the possibility of the living being able to communicate with the dead. And I just want to take a second and ask you, what are your thoughts and feelings initially about spiritualism?
So it's the belief that you can communicate with the dead.
Yes.
I'm agnostic to it. Like, it could be out there. It could not be out there.
I personally have had some very important people in my life pass away. And while I sort of agree with you in that I'm not sure, I sincerely hope maybe you can.
Sure.
You know? And that answer comes purely from a desire of comfort, right?
Yeah.
But
you're more than allowed to have that.
Right? Yeah. And I hope that yes, right? But I don't know. May Reid Sewell had her experience with spiritualism starting in 1897, and she apparently had very many conversations with her late husband, Theodore, and he is sort of the star of her spiritualistic show. Like,
he's just this chatty Cathy.
He is her spiritualism. And I think, like I just said, when you lose somebody really important to you, the thought of never speaking to them again is heartbreaking, especially your husband, I think, or your spouse. To me, it makes perfect sense that she wanted to spend so much time talking to her husband. This behavior, though, did shock a lot of people because May was described as a no-nonsense kind of lady. And for many, you could argue that spiritualism is a little out there.
A little nonsense.
You know, a little nonsensical, if you will.
For this no-nonsense lady.
Mm-hmm. She didn't really share this part of her life with many people, and she didn't talk about dabbling in spiritualism all that much either. And she waited until she was old enough to be out of the limelight to really start talking about this. She didn't want spiritualism to interfere with any potential public presence when she was really active.
Sure.
Around the city and the world.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah, you don't want to be cast aside as like some crazy lady, right?
Absolutely not.
Not when you're trying to make moves and do things. Make moves and do things.
Yeah.
Yeah. She told a reporter from the Indianapolis Star that her husband had warned her about her spiritualism, and then he said she should wait to share communications to the world until she had them in such a form that the world could understand them. And I think what he meant by that was, like, you need to spend time constructing this story of your relationship with spiritualism in a digestible way. You gotta sit on it, you gotta marinate with it before you just out the gate tell people about it. At this point, we have an appearance from another famous Indianapolis person, Booth Tarkington, who I didn't expect at all to be a part of this story. And he is someone who we owe a lot of thanks to for allowing us to know about May's experience in spiritualism.
He's a writer, isn't he?
Correct. Correct. And the reason that we owe a lot to him is because he himself helped May get published with her stories about spiritualism. So Tarkington actually himself had a lot of experiences with, quote, unexplained phenomena. So he was kind of partial to this idea of spiritualism from the get-go. When he was 14 years old and he was living in Indianapolis, he discovered that his sister actually had psychic powers, which I think is super cool.
Whoa.
The family would have seances in their home. These seances would attract quite well-known visitors, such as James Wickham Riley.
This is quite the club of people.
Yes. For all these reasons, when May Reid Sewell approached him about helping her find a publisher for her unpublished spiritualist manuscript, he was really happy to help. In March of 1919, Tarkington decided that he wanted to go with the Bobbs Merrill Company to publish this book. And the Bobbs Merrill Company had its roots in Indy since like the 1850s, so they were kind of well established. And they published books for big name people like James Wickham Riley, George Ade, Meredith Nicholson, and Maurice Thompson. So quite a few Indianapolis authors.
Wow.
In August of 1919, the Bobbs Merrill Company agreed to publish May's book. And Ray speculates that the reason that they decided to publish this book was to kind of get cozy with Tarkington. They wanted to publish one of his books, and they hadn't yet. He was one of the people that they hadn't quite secured.
So they had published all of these people,
mm-hmm.
and they were like, hold on, we're missing one.
Yes.
Booth Tarkington, we want you.
Yes. And we don't know this for fact, but Ray Boomhauer speculates on this. So it could be true, it could be not. Tarkington, at this point, helped May negotiate the terms of her contract. And he also made clear to May that his name, in association with her book, had nothing to do with the fact that she got picked up. Now, we know that Ray thinks it did, right? But Tarkington worked very hard to make sure that May was confident in the fact that her book itself and nothing else whatsoever is what brought them, the publisher, to their favorable decision.
Hmm.
So I think maybe May was having a bit of
a crisis,
perhaps,
of confidence or
perhaps
such.
So then in October of 1919, May was very ill and she was suffering from heart disease.
Oh.
She was so sick that she really couldn't even breathe. And that she had to be, like, propped up in bed just to sit up and exist. She was living at a convalescent home at 1732 North Illinois Street here in the city. But despite all of this, she worked very hard to get her book moving. She corrected proofs and communicated with her editor. She remained confident about the worth of her manuscript, saying, quote, "I think I never did a better piece of proofreading, and I am perfectly delighted with the book. I know it will have an ultimate great success." So it seems as though her confidence...
Love the confidence.
Came back.
Oh, love the confidence of this woman.
I do too. I think we could take a note from May.
Yeah.
Believe in yourself.
Yeah.
When her book was released, reviewers were very nice, Ray says, which I thought was an interesting way to describe reviewing. Like, normally when you hear a summation of reviews, it's
good
rave
or
reviews.
Bad. Yeah.
Or, yeah, or not. Alia Peedy from the Chicago Tribune said that the book had been written in good faith by, quote, "a gentlewoman of high veracity." They added that Sula had found, quote, "an escape from illness and sorrow, and there remains but to extend to her sincere and deeply felt congratulations." J. Keith Torbert from the New York Evening Post wrote, quote, "For those who believe and those who scoff at spiritualism, Sewell's book has essentials to reveal, and that strong, admirable character of Miss Sewell appears on every page."
I don't know about you, but are you getting, like, just a tinge of patronization in these reviews?
I got the patronization from the Chicago Tribune guy.
Yes.
Just, like, good faith and gentlewoman of high ver- like, he wanted to compliment her character, not her book.
Yeah. It almost felt like, oh, it came from a woman.
Oh, good, you poor thing. You did a good job, yeah, given your circumstances of being a woman. Yeah.
Yeah. The Saturday Evening Post felt more like a, this is the book. It was pretty good. You can see the author in it. Like, you can either believe or not believe.
Yeah.
And you'll still get something out of this book.
It's good that you note the difference in them, because the second guy from the Evening Post, he had reviewed several books about psychic experiences. So I think maybe he had just a little bit more insight, or he was a little more used to digesting this kind of content. On her deathbed, Sewell received these reviews, so that was really good for her, I think, mm-hmm, regardless of if they were patronizing or not. She was 76 at this point and was in St. Vincent's Hospital, where she did die on July 22nd, 1920. She was buried alongside her husband, Sweet Theodore, her pen pal, for lack of a better word. What would you call him?
Her ghost husband?
Sure.
Did she ever remarry?
I don't think so, but Ray didn't say.
Oh, okay.
I think if you're spending a lot of time talking to your deceased husband, you don't
other
get a lot of time.
Other suitors aren't going to be coming around.
You don't get a lot of time to talk to the real live ones. That's no shade to May. Like, if my husband died, I'd be
distraught.
Be talking to whatever I could to, like, try and feel him, you know? I personally think.
Sure.
And so, okay, anyway, back to the point. She was buried next to her husband, Theodore, at Crown Hill Cemetery. Upon her death, Indianapolis News wrote, quote, "Miss Sewell possessed the faculty of transmitting her boundless enthusiasm and her original ideas to the world around her. One could not slumber in her presence, for her vitality was contagious." I thought that was really sweet.
That is really sweet.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a really heartfelt, I think, thing to say about someone.
Yeah. No, that is very, very nice.
That's it. That's the end of the blog. And I find myself more of a May Wright fan than I was initially, even though I already was. I think it's really cool that she was able to lean into this. And she seemed like a really pragmatic woman. And so to find comfort in something that's not
traditional.
Yeah. Or seen as all that substantial.
Yeah.
Is sweet to me.
I feel like spiritualism in general, maybe not in the sense of the ability to commune with the dead, but like in the sense of just like belief in like just natural things,
mm-hmm.
like crystals and the moon and yeah. whatnot. Like, I feel like a lot of that just like generic spiritualism is coming back into yes. the fold, which I think is interesting.
I agree. I sort of describe myself as spiritualistic in the sense that I don't know what's right or wrong or real or fake, but I do believe in something bigger, sure. right? And I think May did too. This, I think she found comfort in that she doesn't know everything, and comfort in that, in what you don't understand, you can find the people you love.
Yeah.
I find this is kind of, I find that so sweet that she just wanted to talk to her husband so bad that she would
do that, yeah. do all that. Yeah. That
she would just maybe make herself the target of disbelief, or that ridicule. She would maybe risk her reputation for that.
Yeah. It's what she believed in, though.
Go May.
Go May.
Love. So, what do you have?
Going down the death road, I have a very interesting article from Traces of Indiana and Midwestern History. It is from the fall 2005 issue. It is called An Elegant Vision, Indiana's Landscape Architecture by Malcolm Cairns.
I love learning about green spaces.
Yeah.
So, and I never gave a whole lot of serious thought to the fact that cemeteries are also green spaces.
Yes, they are. And
multifunctional.
So this article is going to take us on a journey from how cemeteries and other kind of green spaces kind of evolve into the design of public park spaces.
Okay.
So how we go from death to family fun.
Death versus life, baby.
Malcolm starts us off by telling us that Indiana has a rich and diverse collection of historic designed landscapes, and those landscape architects include the Olmsted brothers, Jens Jensen, O.C. Simmons, and George Kessler.
If I may, just on a small tangent.
What is the show if not tangents?
Welcome to Reagan's Tangent Hour. The Olmsted brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, like any normal 12-year-old, I was obsessed and have been obsessed since with...
Oh, yeah. White City.
Well, more specifically with the Biltmore.
Oh, yeah.
One of the Olmsteds...
Asheville, right?
Yes. And one of the Olmsteds was hired as a landscape architect, and that is when I first found my love. Am I foreshadowing a bit?
You are foreshadowing a bit.
Sorry. I've just been obsessed with this since 2008, so...
Since middle school?
I'm excited about it.
That's wild.
Yes.
Bringing it back.
Yeah. The end of Reagan's tangent.
We're going to talk about how Hoosiers benefited from the design of public parks, boulevards, parkways, university campuses, state parks, memorials, municipal cemeteries, residential subdivisions, and country estates.
That's a lot.
It's a lot of things. Talking about a lot of things today. So, buckle in.
I hope folks. You heard that click.
I heard it. Reagan just buckled up. When we think about landscape design, that really flourishes in the century spanning from 1840 to 1940, because that's when the profession of landscape architecture really became a thing, right? Before that, it wasn't really considered much of anything. In this century of American landscape architecture, they're most well known for their public and populist creation. And even though you can see a lot of these on a daily basis, they are often underappreciated and can even be like anonymous. This practice emerges in the mid-1800s with the writings of Andrew Jackson Downing, and he is the intellectual support of the profession. He connects the idea of landscape design to American cultural ideas of democracy and a bias for the rural life and the rural countryside, which I think is a very interesting connection to make.
Mm-hmm.
Less so to democracy, but I see it at the same time when you see like memorials and things.
Sure.
But definitely to this idea of rural life, because there's something about public parks that make you feel very agrarian.
They totally make you feel disconnected from this hustle and bustle, or like, you know, a city, even if it's not in a city.
And that's
an oasis. Yeah, totally the point.
We then go on to talk about Frederick Law Olmsted, who is considered to be the father of American landscape architecture.
Hard eyes.
We love him. So he is the one who designs New York's Central Park in 1858. He goes on from this, and he is the one who starts a design movement that is the creation of rural or garden cemeteries that are an English natural style to American landscapes.
Okay.
So this goes from a public park to how can we revamp cemeteries? Because prior to this, when we think of the traditional American rural romantic or garden cemetery, it was a reaction to unsanitary conditions in church and public graveyards. So we go from overcrowded, unsanitary church and public graveyards to these kind of garden-y, romantic, spread out.
And were these like private, like you had to pay to be buried in these places, or were they based per community?
So
what's the difference, I suppose, between public and church versus this?
That's a great question. It doesn't go into the details of like how to get buried there.
Sure.
I feel like it's just like any other cemetery, in which whatever cemetery you go to, you have to purchase a plot of land.
Right. So I guess I'm confused about the designation, but I suppose it's irrelevant. Really, we're talking about the landscape of it.
Yeah, there's this change. So unsanitary conditions, overcrowding, things like that. And the idea that there is a therapeutic effect of natural scenery on the bereaved resulted in the design of cemetery landscapes that provided both adequate sanitary conditions as well as a consoling landscape for the living. These more rural style pastoral cemeteries had flowing lines of drives and paths and massings of plants into picturesque groups, so you could have like directed viewings. And many of the designs for these cemeteries also downplayed the prominence of individual grave markers in favor of larger monuments that punctuated these idyllic scenes.
Wow, you've just painted a picture for me that I have seen. I've been to a cemetery.
Right.
I've been to one like you're describing, but when you describe it with those words, it brings it to life in a way that I never thought about.
Well, because it's odd, right? Like most times nowadays, if you drive into a cemetery, you're like, this place is both gorgeous because of all of that intentional design, but it's so gorgeous for what in, I think, modern day society would describe as a very morbid place.
Yeah, I would say our relationship with death is not, as a whole,
a great one.
Or one that evokes a sense of, like, calmness.
In this time period, these types of cemeteries pop up. Mount Auburn in Boston, Laurel Hill in Philadelphia, Greenwood in New York City, Spring Grove in Cincinnati.
Sorry to interject. I wonder what Crown Hill, when that was founded, is that fallen? Are you going to get there?
Mm-hmm. Graceland Cemetery was actually expanded and modified at this time by O.C. Simmons, and that's in Chicago. That's like Chicago's version of Crown Hill. Indiana's heritage of these cemetery designs is highlighted in Lindenwood Cemetery in Fort Wayne and Crown Hill Cemetery in Indianapolis. And both of these designs were created by English architect John Chislett, who had earlier designed Allegheny Cemetery in Pittsburgh. We have like a very small group of these landscape architects designing all of these different places. Malcolm goes on to say that the grounds of both of the cemeteries reflect successive eras of cemetery design evolving from the rural cemetery aesthetic to garden and landscape lawn styles. These natural and regional landscapes also was one way of representing populist and democratic political values, because these political and social influences and their related aesthetic produced a uniquely American designed landscape.
I'm intrigued.
So we have all of these cemeteries that are adopting this rural style, but there becomes a need for the public park. So the designs of the cemeteries turn into an idea for the American public park.
So these picturesque and pastoral cemeteries predate this idea of a public park.
Yeah.
But am I understanding correctly in assuming that these cemeteries were never intended to be a space to hang out besides in moments of visiting loved ones or mourning, right? They weren't spaces that you hung out in like a park, and that's why there was a need for a public park?
I think the intention, obviously, is to visit the dead, if you will. But like a lot of inventions, it can adopt multiple uses.
Sure.
People were using cemeteries before public parks as public green spaces to like have a picnic.
I see.
Do something. Okay. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And I feel like almost that use spurred the idea for what if we had other public green spaces?
What if we had more of these?
What if we had more of these that didn't have dead people?
Yep, got it.
So it began with Central Park in New York, and then it started to grow further and further. So as cities became more densely populated, parks were recognized as therapeutic escapes from congested cities. And it became a necessity for mental and physical breathing. It was a widely practiced and accepted idea. The earliest parks were designed in the mid-19th century and were conceived as singular elements. So they were just one plot of land. By the 1880s, however, the concept of public parkland was extended to be an interconnected system of parks, large and small open spaces woven together within a system of parkways and boulevards.
I think that parks is something that we got right. I think it's amazing that there are sometimes, right, in our history where we're like, we got that totally wrong.
Yeah.
Thumbs down. But I think it's beautiful that people valued this connection to nature and this idea of physical and mental breathing room, like you said, enough to dedicate time, money, and space to it. And I'm very proud that we did that. Go us, you know?
Woo!
Yay.
Yay. So some examples of this are Chicago's West Parks and South Parks, the Emerald Necklace of Boston, and the Minneapolis Park System. As additional social movements influenced the development of parks, we moved from a park being this passive enjoyment of nature to a place where active recreation and interests in sports and playgrounds evolved. And this was in the early 20th century, so the early 1900s. And part of this came with the Industrial Revolution and increasingly poor and immigrant populations. So there was a lot of reform movements.
Mm.
The typical park in this time period combined the earlier concepts of a rural retreat with the opportunity for public gatherings, discourse, and active recreation facilities and community centers.
I love that a park can do all of that. I think it's amazing.
It is quite amazing that is the case. I don't think oftentimes I think of parks that way.
Our house we just bought is right across the street from a public park, and it can be noisy and you get balloons in your yard or whatever. But for the most part, I find immense joy from it, seeing people use it and getting to experience the multifaceted use of a park.
I grew up in a suburb of a city, so it wasn't like a place where tons of like the parks that we're describing here existed.
Sure.
Necessarily. Because this like idea that you'd have a park system connected by roadways and boulevards is kind of a foreign concept to me.
Yeah, I live actually on a boulevard that connects several parts of this one park.
Yeah.
So when you were describing that, I mean, it's on a much smaller scale than this Emerald Necklace in Boston, I assume, is some larger expanse.
Sure.
But I totally was able to envision that.
this idea of this multifaceted park comes into fruition with the City Beautiful movement that developed post-1893 World's Columbian Exposition. Back to Indiana, George Kessler, very famous name here. Kessler was born in Germany in 1862 and immigrated to Texas originally. In 1882, he was introduced to Olmsted and hired by a Kansas real estate firm to develop plans for subdivisions. So Hyde Park, Roland Park of Baltimore, Euclid Heights in Cleveland, and the development of Ogden, Utah. After completing all of this, he was then hired to do the landscape design for the 1904 St. Louis World's Fair. At around this time, he starts to begin park system designs for Cincinnati, Denver, Indianapolis, and Oklahoma City. The park plans for Indiana cities like Fort Wayne, Terre Haute, and South Bend were all commissions from Kessler. And at the time of his death in 1923, Kessler was continuing his work for the city of Indianapolis. So he had already done some work prior to 1923 and then was doing continued work, specifically looking at the design of an outer ring of parks and boulevards, as well as the campus plan for Butler University.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
Their walking trail or whatever they call that.
Yeah.
That space.
Which is so interesting because isn't that whole area Kessler?
So Kessler Boulevard exists.
Yes.
Right?
I have to drive down it to get home.
You're like,
day.
I know that.
I know that.
And you have Meridian Kessler, right?
Yeah.
But I don't believe that Butler is in like that. There's a different name for the neighborhood of Butler.
Sure. That makes sense. He is known as a designer of the Progressive Era because he combines the aesthetic of Romantic styles as well as formal Renaissance styles. So he's able to combine these two elements. And he's also the one who develops the idea of boulevarding a street, providing a wide right-of-way for the purpose of facilitating traffic on the arteries of a street and allowing for planting of trees in wide margins along roadways.
I love that. When we were house hunting, there would be some streets on the east side that we would go down and they'd have a median of trees and plants and greenery. And that just always, I don't know, allured me.
Yeah.
Loved it. I don't know if that's exactly what you're describing, but...
No, definitely, yeah. In 1909, the Fort Wayne Commercial Club appointed a civic betterment committee, which was hired to prepare a plan for civic improvements. And the study led to the creation of the Riverfront Commission. And in 1912, the Kessler Plan for Parks and Boulevards for Fort Wayne featured a combination of orthogonal commercial and residential boulevard systems with a network of riverfront drives that paralleled the three rivers of the city. So it's all about creating a place that is interconnected.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several places that the Riverside Parkways are diverted to city thoroughfares before reconnecting to the city corridors. Major components of Kessler's plan included Rudzel Anthony and State Boulevards, St. Joseph Parkway, Spy Run Parkway, and Time Drive, as well as Swinney, Foster, and Lakeside Parks. In addition to all of these plans, you also have the city of Indianapolis, and they hire Kessler in 1908 to prepare a park master plan for the community that is going to augment a previous plan that was prepared by the Olmsted brothers. So we have the original plans from the Olmsted brothers. They hire Kessler to
supplement?
Yeah, vamp it up.
Tweak.
Yeah. And he actively worked with the city to implement the plan until 1915. The Kessler Park and Boulevard plan featured parkways that lined major rivers and streams. These parkways, Fall Creek Parkway, White River Parkway, Brookside Parkway, and Pleasant Run Parkway. these serve dual purposes of flood control as well as providing pleasure driveways.
Pleasure.
Nice little pleasure drive. Three of the parkways provided access to planned larger and outer parks of the Kessler system. So you have to remember, all of these parkways connected these parks: Riverside Park, Brookside Park, and Garfield Park.
Got it.
Which are all not super close to each other, if I'm remembering correctly. Because Garfield Park is on the south side.
Brookside is east.
Riverside is north, right? So these are the outer parks of the Indianapolis system, and they're connected by these parkways.
But I wouldn't, my own ramblings, I wouldn't describe Brookside Park as, like, far east. It's, like, near east side.
Sure.
And, like, Garfield is, like, near south side.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Side is near north side.
Sure.
So maybe the parameters of the city as it was structured then, 1915 or whatever.
I'm just thinking in terms of the fact that it takes you 30 minutes to drive anywhere from anywhere.
You're right. To connect That's all of those is quite an extensive plan.
Yeah. Grand.
Grand plan.
Maple Drive, which is now 38th Street, was planned as an urban boulevard providing a northern boundary for developing areas of the city. It was to be connected with similar boulevards on the eastern and western fringes of the city. Now, these remained undeveloped, and although a later extension of the park and boulevard plan, now known as Kessler Boulevard, that connected Fall Creek and White River Parkways, they also prepared plans for several smaller parks like Rodeus Park and a plan for the Indiana State Plaza, a governmental civic center to connect the state capitol to the White River.
Okay.
Which, that's there, right?
There's the government center, which is next to us.
Correct.
But there's no government things closer to the White River. I mean, they're doing a lot of White River things now. I mean,
yeah.
Totally vamping that up.
Oh, yeah. Other detailed designs prepared by Kessler included the formal garden at Garfield Park. The park was developed in 1913, and it maintained the use of the park as a rural retreat, but incorporated more structured recreation, like, yes.
Have you ever been to the conservatory at Garfield Park?
I have been to Garfield Park one time, and it was very nice. I think we parked outside of the conservatory and then walked into the park.
Highly recommend. Very cute.
Yeah.
That's it.
Okay.
Carry on.
Thank you. The park incorporated more structured activity like tennis and baseball, an indoor community center, open play fields for informal active recreation, and Kessler also incorporated Pleasant Run Parkway into the design of the park by blending the north and south drives of the parkway with the driveway loop of Garfield Park.
Okay, cool.
The master plan of Garfield Park is an excellent representative example of attempts to integrate the park and the boulevard system to organize the city plan through open spaces. Because that's what, I mean, seeing Garfield Park, that makes sense.
Yes, I agree.
I've not experienced many parks similar to that.
No, it sort of has this grandeur that, like, I think this connectivity that you're describing lends itself into. And it's one of those things that I think it's fascinating because landscape architecture is about making one feel something about a space without inherently knowing that you're feeling it. It's about experiencing a thing, feeling a way by the way it looks and the way you interact with it.
Well, it's supposed to be about creating this, like, oasis of rural idealism, which I think Garfield Park does that, because I didn't realize how big it was either.
Yeah, it's pretty big, and you don't really feel, if I'm remembering correctly, it feels, it gets perimetered by trees, and so you feel...
It's perimetered by, like, houses.
Along the boulevard, yes, but I feel like, maybe I haven't been to Garfield Park in a while. I feel like when I've been there, it feels private-ish. It feels like an oasis,
is
my point.
It feels secluded.
Yeah.
It definitely feels secluded. You definitely get that vibe, which I feel like is the opposite of what they were hoping to do with interconnected park system.
I suppose they're connecting parks in an effort to create connectivity between parks. Not that each park needs to be,
you know what I mean? Yeah, you know how we discussed walkways and paths within parks?
Yes.
it feels to me like they were trying to create those pathways that are within the parks on a much larger scale. Is kind of what is feeling like for me.
Sure.
A year after Kessler's death in 1923, Lawrence Sheridan became landscape architect for the Indianapolis Parks Department. He prepares the plan for the Taggett Memorial Site at the entrance to Riverside Park, as well as the Birdsall Parkway terminus, and a completed plan for an outer drive system, which was integral for the present Kessler Boulevard.
Okay.
Yes. Kessler himself was also hired by Terre Haute, and he developed their park and boulevard system. He was hired by South Bend in 1911, and he prepared a master plan for the development of a park and boulevard system for that city. And he was just all over the place developing these park systems, which is kind of wild to think about that this one man designed so many places. And it makes me feel like, I don't know when the last time you might have been to South Bend was, but now that I'm like thinking about it, Indianapolis and South Bend have some qualities that are very similar.
I've never been to South Bend, I will admit that. So I will take your word for it.
That's fair. Very fair. The public heritage of these landscape designs of like state parks and things like that continued through New Deal era. Projects including conservation and preservation were associated with things like saving the Indiana Dunes and the design of a state and federal monuments, such as for George Rogers Clark in Vincennes, the Olmsted design of Nancy Hanks Lincoln Memorial in Lincoln City. All of these things, which are part of the New Deal era, are starting to grow. Ironically, the Great Depression benefited public landscape and landscape architects who designed them. The park, forest, and public facilities created through the support of the Work Progress Administration led to widespread expansion of local, state, and national parks. And this was in an effort to provide more jobs for people to create these parks and public spaces.
Okay.
Yeah. Some examples of these WPA landscapes are Mishawaka's Battle Park, Washington Park in Michigan City, and Kimmel Park in Vincennes.
Okay.
Have you ever been to any of those?
I might have been to Washington Park in Michigan City, but I can't quite remember.
It is next to the lake.
Then I have been, yes.
Yeah. It's near the zoo. Look at that.
Look at that.
We've been some places. Rural cemeteries, urban parks, and state parks were created to be visited. But soon, landscape architecture became a place or a profession where private people would pay to create a living space. So this is where places like the Biltmore come in. But also subdivisions. And this isn't something I ever thought of, but like in Indiana, residential communities that have this idea are the Indianapolis Brookside Edition, the suburb, now incorporated, part of Irvington.
Yeah.
Woodruff Place, which Kessler also prepared the design for the Brendanwood subdivision, Washington Boulevard, north of Lakeside Park.
Okay.
And the planned subdivisions of Fort Wayne's Rudizel Boulevard. And this one was very interesting to me, which, have you ever heard of Marktown?
No.
Marktown, an industrial suburb in Hammond, Indiana, it was created by architect Howard Van Dorn and Shaw, which, that's a name.
Yes, it is.
They give, up north, they give historic tours of Marktown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But then they also mention nearby Woodmar subdivision, which was a creation of landscape architect and town planner Jacob Crane. And Woodmar's Knickerbocker Boulevard is a Jensen landscape design. So Jens Jensen, the landscape architect we mentioned earlier, he is the one who designed that boulevard, which is very interesting to me because my parents grew up near Knickerbocker
Boulevard. Oh, interesting.
So I've driven on that boulevard.
You have a personal...
Many a time. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I never realized, because I guess Hammond does have a lot of boulevards.
Again, never been to Hammond, so I'm going to take your word on it.
Like, my grandparents live near a park that is the green space between a boulevard.
I looked up once, like, what does a boulevard mean when we bought our house? And it was described as a tree-lined street.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't occur to me that the fact that I also live next to a park could have influenced the fact that it's a boulevard.
Yeah. Well, and I think boulevards are separated by a wider...
Yes.
And green.
Like a median?
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. So in Hammond, specifically, the one I'm thinking of is there's a park that is about a city block wide mm-hmm. in between the two lanes of the boulevard.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I've driven down. I mean, I couldn't tell you where, but I've certainly driven in spaces where you have one lane going on this side of the park and the other lane on this side. And it's always really nice to drive down those roads because, well, they're beautiful, right?
Yeah. So outside of these residential designs, we also have the idea of estate landscape architecture, like the Biltmore, San Simon, and Vizcaya, or collectively in Gold Coast, enclaves like Newport, Lake Forest, Tuxedo Park, or Beverly Hills. Areas that are like suburban and luxury. And at their best, they represent a marriage of house and garden, fusing interior, architectural, and landscape design. We can see this in Indiana with the Lanier Mansion in Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas Goff's Aurora Estate in Hill Forest, and the J.H. Bass Estate in Brookside in Fort Wayne. In town versions of this include the J.H. Oliver Estate in South Bend and many of the homes that line Meridian Street in Indianapolis.
Yes.
And those kind of garden estates are examples by the Olmsted firm, Simmons, and Jensen. Jensen's Indiana residential commissions included more than 15 landscapes, including the Morstel Plain residence in Hammond, Indiana, and the home that Morstel Plain residence is located on Knickerbocker Boulevard. So I've probably driven by this house.
And you probably have.
Yeah.
You know, you keep mentioning Jens Jensen, and it's taking me back to our Indiana Dunes episode.
Yeah.
Wherein I briefly discuss the backdrop of Alice Gray's life being a Chicago Renaissance, and Jens Jensen was a part of that. And he was a proponent of this connectivity between the drama of the shoreline and the lake and the city. And so it is interesting seeing those views that are similar show up in this story too.
Yeah. Perhaps the most noted of the Indiana country place estates is Oldfields, which is located on the grounds of
Newfields,
which is the art museum.
Yes.
Yes. Now, the property is the historic estate of Hugh McKennon Landon and later of J.K. Lilly Jr. And the mansion was completed in 1914, and the design for the landscape was by the Olmsted brothers in 1921.
We have a series of photos in our digital collection of a wedding at Oldfields. And I think it was the first owner, Landon, his two daughters, had a joint wedding.
Oh.
And the photos are beautiful. They're in black and white, but the florals and the gardens and the way that they're dressed, it is stunning. It's like some of my favorite things in the digital collection because I just think they're absolutely beautiful. So I will get a link for that to our, in the show notes. But when you said Oldfields, I was instant light bulb.
Yes. No, well, there's so many images in the article itself, which we'll also link to. So if you take the time to kind of look at that, definitely look through some of these photos because they are very, very cool. We have kind of reached the end of our article.
Mm-hmm.
But the design of Indiana's parks cemeteries, campuses, communities, and residential landscapes parallels a national trend, and it features the work of some of the country's most distinguished landscape architects, which I wouldn't have expected. Like, I didn't realize how much work the Olmsted brothers
did. I didn't realize Olmsted, but I knew Jensen and I knew Kessler.
I knew Kessler, but I didn't know Olmsted. I didn't know Jensen.
It's really an exciting connection that we have to a national, these nationally known people.
Yeah. And they represent a significant, largely public collection of historic cultural resources, because you don't think of parks as a cult, like a historic cultural resource. You just think of them as a public resource.
Yeah. I think that's what is so alluring to me about a park, is that it is, like you said, a public source resource, but it is so rooted in culture and public programming and democracy and this idea of who we are as a country. I think it is fascinating that a green space can hold so much of a story and so much of a people.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
No, it makes perfect sense. And there is an effort at the time of this article to document, preserve, and recognize a lot of these landscapes in Indy.
I love this article. It was one of my favorites you've ever shared.
It was a wild ride to get from cemeteries to public parks.
Yeah. Wild in that I never thought about it, but in that it makes a lot of sense now that you've talked about it.
Oh, most definitely.
It made me just even more fascinated with green spaces, I think.
Yeah.
Good job. There you go. I loved it. Good job.
Death.
Death and parks and
spiritualism.
All kinds of really cool things.
Oh my.
Oh my, yeah.
Thank you so much, listeners, for joining us on this journey. Bye.
Right, bye.